And I'm here today briefly to ask you to welcome and to introduce Tynan Weir Citizens. How many of you have heard of Citizens Organising or Citizens UK? Oh, a fair sprinkling of hands. Can I declare an interest? Because I am involved at the national level, and it's my job to make sure that Citizens UK is known. So I've got more work to do, but fantastic that some of you already have heard of Citizens. And today, we're going to hear of one of the best examples in the country, Tynan Weir Citizens up in Hexham and Newcastle, who blend together that struggle and celebration, building together a movement from the ground floor up that I would describe really as the seedbed of the future politics of our society. I'm going to say no more except to ask Father Chris, Sarah and Chantelle, who are here, to lead us in a joint workshop. We're going to have a presentation, interaction, you've to work with them, and that will be what we take away and, dare I say, and bring back. Can you give them the warmest of welcomes and let's go?
Good morning.
My name is Chris Hughes. I was the first of six children born to John and Mary Hughes. The six of us came between 1960 and 1971. And family is very important to me. First of all, they keep this cleric grounded. I've got nine nephews and nieces. And my youngest niece, Amelia, got, "Uncle Chris, how on earth did you get a law degree? Did Granddad pay them?" They ground me, but they also have inspired me, I think, three areas of faith, love and service. My mother was brought up in Jarrow in the 1930s. My grandfather was a GP in that time, so some of his practices, patients, would have done the Jarrow March. And my mother, at the age of 15, in the early 40s, was told, when the doorbell rings, because they want Dr. Layden, whoever hears it first opens the door. So my mother, at the age of 15, dressed in her dressing gown, is opening the door to total strangers in the middle of the night. It wouldn't happen now. But it was that sense of service, that who you are is about who you relate to and who you're serving. My father had an amazing faith. He was a young man in the war. He was pike in the Home Guard. And he talked about how faith was really important. He ran a bookshop, and I remember being in his office. I was about 15, and my dad saying to me, you know, there were times when I struggled because I was getting bullied at school, and it wasn't easy for me at the time. And my dad said, look, there were times I didn't know what to do, but I just felt those words, my grace is sufficient for you. I've been a priest for 37 years. I've been involved in organising for the past 10 years, and it's been a real inspiration. So I'll say more later.
Thanks, Chris. And I couldn't be any more different to Chris, really, which is the joy and the beauty of broad-based organising, bringing together a wide and diverse group of people. I'm not a person of faith. I wasn't brought up with a faith. I grew up in the west end of Newcastle, for those who know the area, a place called Cowgate Estate. I grew up in poverty, and I went to what was named and shamed as the worst school in Britain, not by me, but by the Sun newspaper, because I think only 3% of us left school with a GCSE of any grade. So I've worked my whole life really to try and tackle child poverty because of my own experience of it growing up, mainly in the voluntary sector. A little stint in the civil service didn't last very long, went straight back into the voluntary sector. And then came to community organising, really searching for something that was going to actually make a difference, that we could win. Because not only had I spent decades trying to tackle child poverty, and I hadn't succeeded, not only had child poverty not been eradicated, as, do you remember those ambitions? We're going to end child poverty by 2020, wherever it was. It's getting worse. So now in the northeast, we have over 70% of our under fives living in poverty, and most of those in working households. So, you know, I was really having a bit of a crisis of, do I just get a job in a shop, or can I find another way of doing this that is going to actually mean that we win? Because I don't think it's enough to just have good, strong values if we're constantly losing. So that was my route into community organising and meeting the wonderful Chris, and we're going to share some of our stories today, but Chantelle's going to introduce herself too.
So, hello everyone.
Hi.
My name is Chantelle, and currently I'm studying medicine in the University of Sunderland. And I just want to say I'm so happy to meet you all. I know I've spoken to some people already about my campaign, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. But just a bit about myself. The reason why I got into community organising and Tynawea Citizens is because I love the fact that we can come together as one unit and be passionate for change, and being able to experience change as well is what really motivates me to carry on. And I love the fact that we can benefit other people as well, especially in the Bible. I've been Catholic my whole life, and so in the Bible it says, you know, love one another. That's the main message. And I feel like fighting for change, you know, we're able to understand each other's struggles and just understand that and become passionate for change. And really, that's why I got involved.
So before we share some stories with you, we just wanted to show you and tell you a little bit more about what community organising is. A lot of you have said you've come across Citizens UK before, but other organisations use the methodology of organising too. It is just a methodology. It is a way to approach social injustice. It is a tool for our toolbox that we can use to try and bring about social change. Its roots are in America, and Saul Alinsky's writings, Rules for Radicals, started in Chicago in the 1930s in a place called the Back of the Yards during the Great Depression. And it was really came out of a desire that there must be a way of doing politics different to what we have. There must be a way of communities of difference coming together to work for social justice. And we call it broad-based organising. It's broad in two ways, really. Our membership is deliberately broad. So Steve talked yesterday about the state and the market and civil society. I would argue that the state and the market are quite well organised. But in civil society, we can be really quite dysfunctional. I told you that I worked to try and eradicate child poverty for 20-odd years. I had never worked with a faith-based community before. The voluntary sector's over here, faith is over here, the trade unions are over here, education's over here, and never shall we meet to get together, even though we have the same wishes, hopes, dreams and fears. So this is an attempt, it's a bit like a trade union, but for the community, an attempt to bring those strands of civil society together to have more power to effect change. Because this weekend has told us nothing. There is not a crisis of good people. This room is filled with amazing people doing wonderful things in their community. But we have a crisis of power. And community organising has a basic fundamental principle. If you want change, you have to have power. And that had been missing for me in the voluntary sector, any talk of power or how we use it. So this is a deliberate attempt to build power in our community in order to put pressure on the state and the market to win change. And I love this quote from Martin Luther King, because power has a funny, can do funny things to us when we start talking about it, because most of our experience of power will have probably been negative. But power simply means the ability to act. And I love this quote from King because it really sums up a lot of things. You know, power without love is reckless and abusive, and we see that all the time, don't we, in our society. But love without power can be anemic. And for me, that is a food bank. As someone who grew up in poverty, people put on food banks with the best intentions to help people, but we've seen them up and down the country become part of the problem. It's not tackling the root cause of poverty, but has become a sticking plaster, almost an enabler of poverty in our communities. And for me, that is a classic example of love without power. So community organising is an attempt to bring those two things together, and King beautifully describes there for me what justice looks like. And as Steve was saying yesterday, I don't think you can give people power. Me on my own, as a kid from a council estate, I don't have a lot of power. Me with Father Chris and Chantelle, we have a little bit more. But all of us in this room together, now we're talking, we can really start to get things done. So that is, usually we do a 6-day course on this. I'm trying to do this in 6 minutes. So you get the idea of why and how we do things is a little bit different, but there is key fundamental principles that sit behind it. It's not about dominant power, but it's all about relationships. And we've heard beautifully this weekend all about how you build relational power. And what I love about it is that all of us are capable of building power and building relationships in our community. All of you will already be doing that. But it's doing that in an intentional way in order to bring about change. And I fundamentally believe, and I've spoke with some of you this weekend about it, that if you get justice, then you don't need charity. And for me, that is what this work is about, moving beyond that charitable endeavour to have justice, because then charity is no longer required. And we use a five-step model of social change within Citizens UK. We won't have time to go through it in any detail here, but hopefully the stories we share with you will illustrate this in practice. But crucially, it always starts with listening. We never start a campaign because it's something I care about or Chantelle or Father Chris wants to campaign on. It starts with deep community listening. And that's for two reasons, really. It's not an extractive process. It's to find the issues, yes, but it's to find people. People willing to act on it. We don't ask people, what are the issues in your community? And then we'll take them away and solve them for you. We ask people, what are the issues in your community? And do you want to come together to do something about it? And it's the people who share their stories who ultimately take action on those issues, as you're about to see. But it does require power. It requires bringing broad groups together across faith, education and community, listening deeply in our community, having a strategy and a plan. We don't just run at things. We do power analysis. We think it through carefully. Every action we take is to get an intended reaction. It's not just marching on the street and things like that. So we take public action, and then usually that is to get a seat at the negotiating table with decision makers to negotiate for change. So Chris is going to share with you some of his thoughts about how this sits within the tradition of Catholic social teaching. It isn't anything new or complex, and it sits well within a lot of traditions and things people have done for many, many years. And I think it really aligns closely with Catholic social teaching and the things that we've already heard this weekend. So Chris will share his reflections before Chantelle starts us off with some stories and some of the things that we've managed to win by putting this into practice across Tynemere.
So I just want to say briefly the links between our tradition from the Catholic community to organising. First, before I address Catholic social teaching, I want to talk about the wider tradition of the Church. Those people that formed the Second Vatican Council, De Lubac, Congar, Rana, Skilabix, they were young men in the war. And their experience challenged their understanding of what the Church is. Because they were with people who were other Christians, Jews, people of no faith, and yet working together to a part of the French resistance and part of fighting Nazi Germany. And they were sacrificing their lives, you know, really Christ-like virtues. And yet there were good people, good Catholics going to church, saying their prayers and driving the trains to Auschwitz on a Monday morning. And they kind of think, well, you know, what's going on here? So in the Second Vatican Council, a sense of church was changed. And in many ways, it's everyone, the people of God. Yes, there are circles of communion, but we're in this together, journeying as pilgrim people of God. And in many ways, my sense of working with citizens is that we're a people together. My colleague in the diocese, Father Adrian Tockwell, who runs the Caritas department in our diocese, when we spoke to Bishop Stephen, said, really, in addressing, working with citizens, working with the 37 institutions that are, he realises it's truly Catholic. It really is universal, working together. So there's something about our understanding of the Church. Another aspect of the Second Vatican Council was the importance of dialogue. And as Sarah said, one-to-one conversations really is important. And dialogue isn't simply share our opinions or find consensus. It's getting to know each other, getting to understand each other, working together. And it's been marvellous for me as a priest getting to know all sorts of people that I wouldn't have met if I hadn't got involved with citizens. And lots of people wouldn't have met me and come across the Catholic Church. There's a sense of mission. Now, I see mission about going out there, and I'm really excited by the synod process, and I see a lot of overlap with the synod process and organising. I taught mission and ministry for 10 years, and one aspect, one model of ministry that I got from two American Divine Word missionaries in their books, Constance in Context, was the idea of prophetic dialogue. You were prophetic, you witnessed, you have your values, you have your faith, but let's engage, let's encounter. I remember Archbishop Kelly, who was chair of governors when I was on the staff at Ushaw, saying, as a Catholic community, we can guarantee where God's grace is. We can't guarantee where God isn't. You know, and so an openness to where God's grace. Let's be a people of witness and standing for our values, but we are attentive to the other and willing to listen and hear what they have got to say to us as well. And also my sense of ministry, I think, is really important. Often ministry is relegated to who does what, when and how. Now, as an ordained priest, I see my role is to shape the baptismal priesthood of everyone. And therefore, there's a whole range of ministries, what they were all involved in. Prayer and worship, witness and evangelism, teaching and formation, pastoral care, prophetic and social outreach and administration. I'll come to prayer and worship in a minute, but I see the other activities very much involved in organising. We are being prophetic. In being attentive in the one-to-ones, that's pastoral care. I've seen people grow and develop, like in Chantel, that's formation. You've got to be organised. Administration really, really matters. So I see the different ministries engaged in organising. And also, in prayer of worship, yes, we don't have formal prayer and worship, but we are encouraged to share our values and share something that matters. So at Holy Week, I shared a kind of reflection I'd written on Mary witnessing Jesus doing the Stations of the Cross. And that was, you know, people respected it and it enabled one of our Muslim members of our leadership group to share her values and faith. And so there's an openness. So they're willing to, we can share and listen. And I think that's really, really important. Yeah, Rana talked about the anonymous Christian. You know, people who are Christ-like, even they don't know they are. And I've met many, many people in Citizens who, are, for me, are anonymous Christians. Next slide, please. In terms of Catholic social teaching, the dignity of the human person is key, that we have human rights that are important to what it means to be fully human. And in the one-to-ones, it's a spiritual practice. You really discover the value, the worth, the beauty, sacredness of the other in that one-to-one. We're seeking for the common good. Yeah, it's about those on the margins. Yeah, they matter. Their voices matter. Solidarity and subsidiarity, I think, are really important. In listening, you get a sense of what really people are struggling with. So you get that profound sense of solidarity. And subsidiarity is about power at the right level. Power can be really at the right level. We're going to hear how a group of young people realised that they had power and could make a difference. So power isn't just up there. We can have power, but we have to be organised to make it happen. So power at the right level, yes, that's what organising is about. Some of our work has been concerned about the environments and caring for our common home. We transformed a local park that had been allowed to go to rack and ruin by the local council. And I think finally, something that struck me this weekend, I've never really made the connections of organising in terms of peace building and peacemaking. But I was, what Steve shared yesterday in terms of bringing about change. And I suppose we've never really talked about non-violent resistance. But reflecting on it last night, what we're trying to do is non-violent transformation. We are, standing up for injustice, making a change, making transformation, but with no violence. So in many ways, I've never seen it until this weekend, that actually one aspect of our work is peace building. So now let's hear a story about change from Chantal.
So where do I start, honestly? There's so much to say. So I guess I'll start with how it all began. So I was part of community organising when I was in sixth form. So this is around a year ago. And it was me and two of my friends who were involved, as well as our school chaplain. And what we did was we created a campaign called Fairer Bus Fares for young adults. And that was the main thing. So the issue was that children over the age of 16, they had to pay adult fare to get to the same school that they were studying with, that people were under 16, which we thought was kind of unfair. And we collected many testimonies from different students. And the main thing they were saying was, even if they had part-time work, most of their wages were going to the bus fares. And we thought, again, that was totally unfair. It was a big impact, obviously, on their families, especially with the cost of living crisis and minimum wage. So that was the main issue that we found. And so how did we do it? Like mentioned before, we conducted listening campaigns, and the main thing was listening to each other, and we collected the different testimonies on how the bus fares were impacting their lives. And after that, it was just our small group, trying to organise a meeting with Arriva. And so we wrote up a letter, and we sent it to the CEO of Arriva, and she was called Kim Purcell. So we wrote this letter and sent it to her. However, we received no reply. So essentially, we were rejected at that point. And to help us get further up the ladder, what we did was we met with the previous mayor of North of Tyne. It was Jamie Driscoll at the time. And by meeting him, we were able to, you know, gain that relationship with him. And we also invited him to the Citizens Assembly, where he was able to speak, on this issue. And he also, on our behalf, sent a letter to Arriva, to Kim Purcell, outlining what we wanted from our campaign. And guess what? We received a reply from Arriva in 20 minutes of Jamie Driscoll sending that letter. How crazy is that, honestly? But, yeah, so that reply that we received eventually, it didn't, however, answer our questions on getting cheaper bus fares. We were given almost solutions, which weren't kind of solutions. They told us to, like, buy an annual pass for £500, which, you know, it's totally not feasible for students. So that was that. And so in the letter, we had mentioned that we wanted to meet the CEO of Arriva, Kim Purcell. And since we received no reply, we took matters into our own hands. We all went to Arriva ourselves, and we went to the Arriva headquarters. And, yeah, that happened. And now I'm going to talk about what happened during the meeting. So prior to actually going, we practiced many role plays in school, and we're able to just play out the different characters, like Kim Purcell, and we acted as if she was angry on one hand, or like if she was really, really nice to us, just to get practice, you know? And in the actual meeting, she was lovely, honestly. She was really welcoming. She was so eager to get involved with us young people and to create change. And this is where it kind of gets a bit funny. So before we had the meeting, before we all spoke to her, she actually went to the bathroom, right? And in that time, we quickly decided to reorganise the room, move the tables and chairs quickly before she came back, and made sure everything was perfect for this meeting. And so she came back and we all sat down. And in the end, she agreed to... So if the government were able to fund... they were able to bring in money, she agreed that she would put it top priority to subsidise young people's bus fares. And so that was a good sign. And after that, honestly, we were just so happy that that she was able to agree to that. And we all went outside together collectively, and that's when we met with the citizens group. So there was citizens group, our sixth form, so we'd all come together. And the thing was, we were dressed up in like professional outfits. For example, like nurses and scientists. And the whole point was that we were wearing like oversized clothes to make it look like we're not adults, and like it kind of looks silly, you know, with our big lab coats and stuff. And so I wore my mum's nurse uniform. And then I know some people wore like lab coats and their goggles and stuff. And we also sang like nursery rhymes that were quite relevant to the situation. For example, Wheels on the Bus. And we thought, yeah. And I just want to reiterate that it was very important for us that we made the whole process fun, that we were able to, you know, dress up as well as, you know, sing nursery rhymes just to show that, you know, this is not violent at all, that we're trying to fight peacefully to actually see an impact. And that was very important for us. So after all of that happened, there was a few months of silence. And then we were so happy to hear that they'd reduced the fares from £2.20 adult fare to £1. So that was truly amazing for all of us. We were so happy. So that's a £1.20 saving for each student. So it's £1 each way. And that's under 21. And so... it was really amazing that we'd all come together, you know, to get that one outcome, which we know will benefit so many people. It's going to benefit 23,000 students in the Northeast who are from that age, you know, still in education. So I think it's really amazing. And the main things that I learned from this process, from community organising, was the fact that as young people, our voices are heard. Just to the young people here, I don't know if you think the same, but I thought that, like, there's no way we can create change. It's people who are much higher up in the ladder, you know, only they can have the final say. But the thing is, as young people, we can create pressure, you know, by coming together, and I think that's the most important part. We can come together, create that pressure to create change, essentially. And the most important thing is about the communications that we've had along the way. Michael, our chaplain, my two other friends, Mishma, Eve, who are involved in this process, as well as the Tyne and Wear Citizens people, everyone sitting here today. You know, it's all a big collaboration. And that's what I learned, honestly, that as young people, we have a voice. And the second thing that I learned was the importance of persistence. So this campaign was, it was the whole of my sixth form. So the 2 years, yeah, 12, year 13, we were working on this campaign. We received many rejections, no replies. And so it was important that we'd keep meeting people, you know, to work up this ladder. But it's actually possible, which is amazing. And it was honestly the highlight of my sixth form experience. I learned so much, and I'll definitely take this into the future. To inspire, hopefully I can inspire more young people and everyone sitting here today as well. I remember I already shared like my story with so many people here, and it was honestly lovely speaking to you all. It's just amazing, but I feel so grateful as well being here, being able to share this story on behalf of all of us. It's truly amazing that we're able to create such an impact. And I just want to end by saying why this is important. So I think community organising is very, very important because it's important that we fight for justice to ensure that everyone is feeling safe and secure and that everyone is being treated equally, essentially. And this is also mentioned in the Catholic social teaching. So it's very important, as well as in the Bible as well. The main thing is to fight for justice, to allow everyone's voices to be heard. And yeah, just coming together as a community, that's very important because it creates power and it creates that pressure And all it takes is like-minded people to come together who are passionate about one thing, and we can come together, create that pressure, and ultimately we can experience change. And it's just amazing. So that's what we did with the bus campaign, and I'm so grateful to be able to, you know, share this story today in front of you all. And that's it. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, Chantel. We really struggled with what stories to share. We're going to briefly share a couple of other examples. If you could go back one slide for the minute. I want to share a story with you about a school-based counselling campaign because it incorporated some work with the regional election as well as the general election, because we do try to create change hyper-locally, but also as well, we want to change policy nationally. All good campaigns start with listening, and so did this one. It too started in Chantel School in St Thomas More, North Shields, back in 2017, Chris?
Yeah.
And there was Chris, myself, an Anglican priest called Simon, Michael, the school chaplain, and we went into the school. They just joined Citizens, and we said, you know, are you interested in politics? And they all said, no, not really. And we said, OK, what are you interested in? Let's get talking about the things that concern you, what's putting pressure on you, your family, your community. And they came up with two things, student fees and mental health. And that was where this campaign all started. We did listening across all of our members, and as Chris said yesterday, I think it was, mental health was voted as the top issue affecting people across the North East, which was a surprise to many of us, given the kind of issues of poverty and inequality in the region. It was mental health that was at the forefront of people's minds. Because it was a big, complex issue, we launched a Citizens Commission on Mental Health, and these pictures are from that, that commission. So we tried to be clever about it. We formed a commission of 12 experts. And it's amazing if you just say, we're going to have a commission and we want you to be on it. People are so pleased to be asked to say yes. So it included the chief executive of the NHS Mental Health Trust, the mayor, the Bishop of Newcastle, Kat McKinnell MP, who's now in cabinet, is the school's minister, and some young people from St Thomas More School, some practitioners and some people receiving mental health support. So we were already assembling the power that we needed to act on the issues that came out of it. We had public hearings, we had hundreds of testimony, and there were 17 actions that came out of that. We don't have time to go into it all, but one of them was students at St Thomas More redesigning a CAMHS clinic, which they said was a bit like a prison. In fact, they found that the paint on the walls was the same paint that they use in prisons, and the young people got agreement from the trust to redesign it. But crucially, what came out of this campaign was that young people said there was a missing middle between CAMHS and low-level support of what do you need when you don't quite need CAMHS support, but some intervention would make a difference. And what they said they wanted was access to a school-based counsellor, a qualified counsellor in school, so they didn't have to go out externally to appointments because they found that quite difficult, but in a safe space like a school. And it's a bit of a lottery as to whether your school will have a counsellor or not. And they found that this was legislated for in Wales and Scotland, that there is statutory provision for school counselling, but not in England. So that became the campaign, started from St Thomas More. If you go on to the next slide, you'll see some pictures of the students at the top. We had an assembly for our regional election that we just had in May. And you can see all the candidates on the stage. And it's not like a hustings. So what happens is people come up and share their story. The students there, the student with the blonde hair, shared her story about having school attendance at 47% because of her mental health and getting it up to almost 100 and sitting at GCSEs. And she asked all of those standing to be our regional mayor, if you're elected, will you put some money in to pilot school-based counselling in our region? And they said yes. I think there's a little picture of them with their paddles. It's amazing what people, what commitments you can get at election time. Now, of course, this is part of our strategy. Use this as an opportunity. I would argue that voting in elections is only one way of changing things. But it is an opportunity for us in our community to get accountability into democracy. We can have a just politics, but unfortunately we have to fight for it. And we do have a job to do in making sure that they follow through with the commitments that they pledged, but it's a lot easier when they do it in front of 2,000 people. The next slide will show is a meeting in Father Chris's church in North Shields with Alan Campbell, who is the local MP and is also currently Labour Chief Whip. And the young people have met with Alan many, many times now, haven't they? They once marched to his office in the rain to talk about school-based counselling. And this meeting was only a couple of weeks ago, week before the election. There was about 70 people there. There were people from the parish, people from the primary school, the secondary school, the local mums group, who were all meeting with Alan, who know him well. And Alan said to them in that meeting, you know, when you set up Tyne and Wear Citizens, I bet you thought you would influence a few things, but you are influencing national policy, because if we are elected, which obviously they were, we will commit £250 million to school counselling.
Every year.
And he said, we'll do that by cancelling the non-dom tax status. It was great, wasn't it? So we got that pledge. We will hold them to it. The next slide shows us a few... Is there another slide? Sorry. Well, maybe not. Sorry, ignore me. We also took it to a general election assembly with Angela Rayner and some of the candidates. We also did get a shout-out from the Green candidate on the TV debate. Carla Denier did mention it and say that she had signed the Citizens' Pledge to implement school-based counselling and asked the other candidates, will you do the same, which was great. So it is possible to influence not just our local community but national politics if we organise ourselves well. And you can see the impact of the parish council. It's not just Chris and I doing this. This is people impacted by the issue leading it. But you have to have a clear ask. I think we've talked about that this weekend. There's no good just describing how awful things are. We were very specific. Will you or will you not fund school-based counselling in our schools? That will not in itself solve the crisis of mental health, but it will go a hell of a long way towards it. And the job now is to hold them accountable and make sure it happens. So watch out for that announcement soon. Yeah.
Thanks, Sarah. Another key part of the work of Citizens UK and Tyne and Wear Citizens has been the living wage. The whole living wage movement started from East London citizens, and it was people working in Canary Wharf, either as cleaners or as security people, mainly mosques or church attenders. And in the one-to-ones, you know, what concerns you? Well, they were paying their bills, but they're working 60 hours a week. And they said, we just want more time with our families. That's what we want. Wasn't this even more money? We just want more time with our families. And so a living wage would do that. When Tyne and Wear Citizens started, there were just 30 living wage employers in the whole of the northeast of England. There are now 333. And so we've had various campaigns to put pressure on various big organisations. So the two universities, Newcastle University and Sunderland University, we did a campaign just before Christmas for Sunderland University, and we got dressed up and we changed Christmas carols into songs about poverty and the living wage. And of course, at first, you get resistance. They don't want to change, but you put pressure. You get an action to get a reaction, and Sunderland University became a living wage. Sunderland City has become a living wage employer as well, which is great. Also, Newcastle United Football Club. I think they can afford it. and Newcastle City has become a living wage city. So it's a movement, and we're working on that. And one of our national campaigns is that, you know, we saw during the COVID lockdown, yes, we got out on a Thursday and clapped the carers, but they're not getting properly paid, are they? So one of our campaigns is during the election was that all health and care workers get the living wage, as isn't the case in Scotland and in Wales, but it's not in England. So we met with Angela Rayner, had the assembly with Angela Rayner, and we think we're nearly there, don't we? We're hoping we're going to get a commitment on that. It is really about the dignity of the human person, the dignity of work, and that they should, to have time with their loved ones. That's so important. But we've got to lead by example. There are 30 dioceses in England, Wales, and Scotland. Only 7 have been accredited as living wage employers. That is shocking. One diocese in Wales, Cardiff, and of course they're about to merge with Menevia, so that would be 2. There's one diocese in Scotland, Paisley, and just 5 dioceses of the 19 in England. Westminster was the first. There's Birmingham, Brentwood, Salford, and I'm pleased to say Hexham and Newcastle. So if I haven't mentioned your diocese in the past 30 seconds, it means your diocese is not a living wage employer. And they talk about their wonderful statements, cost of living. They challenged the government on the 2-child benefit cap. But are they going to practice what they preach? So you'll be thinking about what is it that you want to bring about? What changes? What can you do out there? Well, wouldn't it be great if this time next year over half our diocese were living wage employers? Yeah? So I please gently encourage you that if your diocese is not a living wage employer, you work with those others that you know in your networks, in your groups. Yeah. Get those conversations. We're happy to support and help in actions. Yeah, it would be great if your diocese, if we had at least of the 16 dioceses of the 30 in England, Wales, Scotland, living wage employer, that would be inspiring. Go for it. Thank you.
We're running short of time. We want you to do some things. So I'm going to go at fast speed through a couple of other quick examples. I would encourage you to go on our website and look at this Just Change one, because it really was led by the Catholic community. And it came from some listening in a school. I think I'm an expert in child poverty. No one can tell me anything about it. We went in, did some work with 10 students who said, you know what would help me? If I could have me change off me dinner money. And we're like, what do you mean? And she said, well, if you get free school meals, it's all biometric fingerprint system now. When I was a kid, you used to have to queue up for a little ticket, but it's now all electronic. She says, every day I put my finger on and I get £2.20 balance for my dinner money. If I'm off school, where does my £2.20 go? And we were like, we don't know. She said, because if I'm off school, there's no more food in my house. If I had £4 the next day, I could eat more food, because it can only be spent on food. It's not a cash transaction. So we asked the head teacher. He didn't know. He said he would go away and find out. And he found out that the money was retained by the provider of the meal as profit. In this case, it was Chartwells. And the university, who's one of our members, did some research and found it was £88 million lost from free school meal allowance every year. So while we're working our socks off providing food bank, this is what I mean by justice. The money that is allocated for the poorest children to spend on food is being taken from them. At that time, we didn't think we had the power to go against Chartwells. We did write to them. They didn't get back to us. But the Catholic bishop at the time, Bishop Seamus, came to one of our assemblies and said, you know, we have a lot of schools in the Catholic diocese. We will commit to looking at this as within our Catholic schools. Bishop Paul, the Bishop of Durham, the Anglican Bishop, and the Bishop of Newcastle were in the audience. So they tweeted, actually, so will we. So we got a meeting with the Anglican and the Catholic schools, with the education department, and there was an amazing head teacher called Dame Maura Reagan in Darlington who said, well, I'm actually my own school provider, I can do this. And she went away, she spent £250 on an IT system, and she changed it so that the kids' dinner money rolled forward. And I think it was in 1 year in one school, £17,000 went back to those children. So even when we think we don't have the power to take on the big things, we often have the power locally to do something, especially as a diocese. There's great things that can be done. But there's more information on the website. I just want to show you a couple of other pictures. The next slide is a campaign we did It was led by the Muslim Sisters in Newcastle around developing a hate crime policy on our public transport. There'd been a massive rise in Islamophobic attacks since the Brexit vote across Newcastle, and there was no hate crime policy. And they led a great, this was the Claim the Metro action, where everyone wearing hijab here is people of all faiths and no faiths in solidarity with the sisters, and they won that hate crime charter. The next slide, I couldn't do this with Chris and not show you this picture, which was the park the park development campaign that we ran, which came out with COVID, and women with young children who had no green parks, having their local park had no swings on the swings. And when they wrote to the council, I still have the letterheaded paper that said they couldn't put swings on the swings because the dogs had ate them. And it was basically saying, you working class folk can't look after your stuff. We're not going to put nice things in your park. And there was a great campaign during COVID. You could only have 30 people outside who cleaned up the park. And this is Father Chris in the dog costume, pretending to eat the swings, which obviously got us press and publicity. So, yeah, what is it you say, Chris? Be a fool?
I hardly wear a dog collar, but I wear a dog suit. I mean, it's...
Sorry, Chris. Next slide, please. So what we want you to do now, we've given you, we've thrown loads of information at you in a short space of time, but the foundation of all this is the relationships. So we want you all to go and have a one-to-one relationship now. You can do that with someone that you don't know, but equally, we were chatting with John yesterday, even someone that you think you do know very well, you might not have had a conversation like this for some time. And it's not about the weather and it's not about conference, but it's something a little bit deeper. We try to do that at the beginning with our introductions. Who are you at the core? Why do you care about justice? What is it that got you here this weekend? What keeps you going? Because this work is hard, right? What is the fire in you that keeps you going to do this? And there's no agenda. The agenda is just you and the other person building a deep, meaningful relationship. And we're going to give you a good 10 minutes to do this just now with one another, because this is the magic that makes all of this action happen. And we'll come back together just before the break. Is that okay?